Subcommittee on Government Accountability and Information Technology to order. And we're going to open with I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2057. Could you give us a summary of that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2057 would create the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability within the Legislative Fiscal Office. And would delegate the responsibility for conducting performance program and management evaluations or reviews of state agencies, state programs, and other state funded programs and other state-funded programs. It replaces the Joint Legislative Audit Committee with the Joint Committee on Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability, and charges that committee with overseeing and evaluating the reviews conducted by the office. The measure would repeal the statutory authority for the Secretary of State to conduct performance and program audits. This measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage and signing by the governor. There is, as noted on the bottom of the staff measure summary, the measure also has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and as such, we have not received a fiscal impact statement on it.
Do we have a sharing up list? Okay, I'm going to call John Latimer. If you would state your name and who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Latimer, and I'm representing the Public Commission on the Legislature. I served as the co-chair of the Subcommittee on Management and Human Resources of the Public Commission on the Legislature. And it's really good to be back. It's kind of like old home week. Many of you don't know, but I was legislative fiscal officer for 10 years in this body. Enjoyed it. I left when term limits made it a much more difficult job for everybody.
You need to hurry. Excuse me. Representative Cromwell, are you in a hurry at all? Do you have to leave quickly?
Just sometime before 2.
Okay, I'll just go ahead with this testimony then you can leave.
Okay.
Sorry about that, John.
Yeah, let me get through this quickly then. The Public Commission, one of the things, and I don't know how many of you read the report of the Commission, but it was set up by Senate Bill, whatever it was, I can't remember, 1084, something like that. And a couple of the things that we did as a commission is look at what kinds of things that were causing the problems that everyone was talking about with the legislature. And in my committee, in terms of looking at the management and staffing of the legislature, looked at some of the things that we felt were important for the legislature to change or to deal with. Part of that was because the legislature, and one of your singular duties, it seems to me, is oversight of the executive branch. And one of the things that members of the commission have felt when they were putting this together was that the authority of the legislature had been diminished over time, and the authority of the executive branch was they had a lot more power and authority than the legislature has. And it's really part also of the Constitution. So the commission adopted 7 issues that they were trying to deal with. 2 of those were dealt with the reduction of the independence and authority of the legislature as they perceived it, and of the complexity of the issues and funding problems that the legislature is dealing with. So our committee looked at, because we were asked to, look at the issue of auditing. We got a lot of questions that people, the public submitted and others submitted, and we looked at the auditing issue. And we held hearings. We heard from the state auditor. We heard from the Legislative Fiscal Office, from lawyers representing both, from Legislative Council and from Department of Justice. And the committee decided that probably what we don't want to do is get into a battle over who should be doing audits. In fact, the committee was very clear about that. Where you could make an argument that the audit function is an oversight function that ought to be done by the legislature. The Constitution gives that in Oregon to the Secretary of State. And rather than getting into political arguments about who should be doing the audits and what the Constitution says or doesn't say, the committee felt that it was more important to get to this notion of oversight in terms of program evaluation, policy analysis, and accountability of state programs. And because they're so inextricably tied to the budget, the committee felt that it was really important to have a professional staff with the academic training and the ability to do the kind of program evaluation and policy analysis that we felt that the legislature needed. And that includes things like cost-benefit analysis, which does take some training to know how to do. But it's different from auditing. Auditing in many ways, and I don't want to denigrate my good friends from the auditor's office, but auditing tends to be after the fact. And what we talk about in the commission was we really need ongoing analysis for the legislature so that as you're in session or even in the interim when you have interim committees, you need that kind of analytical ability to help you with the decisions that you need to make. And we felt that a professional staff could then present you with reports that would look at the department's ability to plan to meet their goals and your goals and meet legislative intent, budgeting to ensure that resources are available to carry out their plans, and then measuring to assess progress and link resources actually used to results achieved. One of the things that we talked about in the committee was that quite often all we do in measuring performance is we measure activities rather than actual accomplishments. What a good program evaluation staff will do is measure performance. And the legislature has, I think since the early 90s, been trying to look at how we can get departments to provide performance measures, and then how do we measure those departments' abilities to meet their goals and those meet that performance. So our whole notion here in what we were proposing to the legislature was to establish in a professional staff within the Legislative Fiscal Office, because we wanted to tie it to the budget, because that's where your real authority in setting program policy year after year is situated, and it's the one constitutional authority the legislature really has, is to establish that budget and budget parameters. And we also felt that that staff should have the strong training and use professional standards in doing the work they do. As I look at this bill, I'm a little perplexed because it purports to do things that we really didn't recommend. As I look at both the preamble to the bill where it talks about eliminating the statutory authority for the Secretary of State to do performance and program audits, that's just actually counter to what the committee wanted to do. We don't think that we want you or to get into that kind of political battle about the role of the Secretary of State. That's not what this is about for us. It was about giving you the staffing ability to do the kinds of policy analysis, cost-benefit analysis that we think that you need. So I think if I had my druthers, that part of the legislation would be changed to make it clear, because I'm afraid that if you're going to get into partisan battles just because you happen to have a Democrat Secretary of State now, you're going to get into partisan battles about that. And that's not what we were trying to do. We were trying to get the legislature in a position of being staffed appropriately to do the kinds of oversight that we think the legislature is established to do. One final thing, there's a word in the bill that talks about, if I can find the bill here. It says on line 14, and I think it may say in other places on the first page, Officer Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability shall conduct performance program and management evaluations or reviews. Now, all of those terms have definitions in the literature, in both academic training and in professional standards. But reviews are a term that lacks the kind of definition. It's used by auditors, and so I would take that word out if it were me, and that's just me, because it doesn't quite have the everybody agrees on what review means. Finally, we really talked a lot about making this a professional staff, and you may not know this, but there are in universities there are actually people are trained to do program evaluation and policy analysis. In fact, right next door at the Atkinson School of Management, they have coursework in this. I know that because I taught it at one time. But they do teach it in the universities. And on top of that, you have many state legislatures with these kinds of organizations. And, in fact, there's a National Program Evaluation Legislative Society. And those folks meet periodically around the country to talk about their profession and how they do this work. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you have some amendments that you were going to offer?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, no. I'm just, these are my suggestions, and they're only my personal suggestions. I think that the committee you could decide how you want this bill to look. I'm just thinking as I read what the staff measure summary says and what the bill says, that I think it would create some consternation in many people's minds about just exactly what the bill does. To me, the Constitution clearly gives the audit authority to the Secretary of State, the Department of Justice, in successive opinions, starting back with Attorney General Frohnmeyer, has said time and time again that the Constitution gives that authority to the Secretary of State. All I'm saying, I don't want to get into that argument with this bill. I think this bill should be geared towards the program evaluation and policy analysis. I don't know how to amend it to do that.
Representative Blair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not quite sure how to ask this question because I really don't want it to be political. But from listening to your testimony, I'm wondering if you think that outside of that it's housed in the Secretary of State's office, that maybe you're questioning the quality of the staff?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I am not at all. They have very high quality staff over there. The audit function is different from the kind of function that our committee was trying to propose.
Okay.
The kind of function we were trying to propose was an ongoing analytical process for evaluating both through the budget process and after the budget process, how departments were functioning in performing on the kinds of things you want them to do as you establish their budgets. The audit process is very important. I didn't tell you at one time I was state auditor, so I certainly wouldn't talk against that function. It's a very important one. I just think what I'm talking about and think you need to do is separate the two and not get into that battle of who should do it.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards?
Yeah, Representative Beyer kind of asked my question, so I guess I'm concerned about the politics that could be involved with this. I mean, I don't see it as a Republican or a Democrat type issue. I mean,
I don't either.
The next Secretary of State could be a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, either way. So I guess what I'm trying to understand, because I wasn't privy to the process of the Public Commission on the Legislature, or I wasn't a part of it. It sounds like there was some disconnect between recommendations and what was proposed should happen, and then what is coming here before this committee. And was
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, maybe a little history is important so you understand why that was an issue. There has been legislation over a couple of past sessions, going back even into the late 90s, to create a legislative audit function, and it got very partisan because of the current Secretary of State. Those bills were introduced by Republicans, and the current Secretary of State is a Democrat, and I think that's why some people felt we needed to back away from that, because it was seen as, by some people, not everyone, as a partisan attempt to change the authority of the Secretary of State. The problem is it's never been solved by any court suits, and so we have no court interpretation of what the Constitution says, just interpretation by the Attorney General.
Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up question. Is this duplication, or is this... I guess I'm not really clear about... I understand the need for that supportive analysis within the legislature, and I think it sounds like a good thing to me. I guess I'm looking for a little bit more explanation of to what extent does that overlap with the Secretary of State's audits division, and to what extent should we move on forming this office? I mean, is the political battle on then at that point, because they're both doing the same thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, no, I think that's why we on the Public Commission on the Legislature were trying to make that separate analysis and separate recommendation. We don't want this to be an audit office. Auditors follow very strict auditing standards. Program evaluators follow program evaluation standards, and they're different. Audits tend to be more expensive. If you were to go out and hire an auditor from a public accounting firm to do a performance audit, it would probably cost you in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. In this case, we're talking about a staff that's not going to be cheap, but it's going to give the legislature that constant analysis of performance and cost benefit that we didn't feel that you have now.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thanks. Actually, he was here when I was here, so there's a little bit of continuity. We go a ways back, and I'll tell you, the state lost something when they lost John. But, John, I'm trying to read through this bill, and I see it in the summary where it repeals the statutory authority of the Secretary of State to conduct performance and program audits. I'm trying to actually find where it's repealed in the bill. Do you know?
No, I don't. The problem is what it does is it eliminates the old Joint Committee on Legislative Audit. And in doing that, there was some language in there. The state auditor is here, and maybe he can answer that question because I can't.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
I'm really referring mostly to the staff major summary and the preamble in the bill.
Yeah.
The summary in the bill.
Try to read through the Latin from the back. You're going to go, okay.
In addition, one thing, Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I was very much involved in the original drafting of this legislation back in 91. And it was a compromise then. Between the legislature and the Secretary of State. At that time, both houses of the legislature were controlled by the Democrats, as was the Secretary. And it was a compromise, and we worked very carefully together to make sure that we didn't step on each other's turf. And I noticed in reading the bill, I didn't know this, but it's been added to over time quite a bit. So a lot of what you see in this bill I had nothing to do with, but...
You deny this all responsibility at this point, is that right? Any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell? Thank you for coming, Representative. I know your time is valuable, and we appreciate you coming to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk a little bit about House Bill 2057. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is not Westland anymore. I have Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Just a couple of things that I would like to point out to the committee with relationship to this. I think, let me preface that by saying that the idea of creating a legislative audits office is a very good idea. One of the things that we are lacking as a legislature and in the legislative branch is the kind of oversight that we really need to be able to have if we're going to be effective in terms of really understanding what the agencies are doing, how they're utilizing the dollars, and when we put performance measures out on the agencies, which really should focus on outcomes, not just focusing on 90% of this or 10% of that, but really focusing on the outcomes in terms of what it is that we're buying when we spend $5 billion in education, when we spend $1 billion in higher education, when we spend $9 billion in all funds for DHS. What are we really buying? When we spend $2 billion in public safety, what are we really buying? And we have no way of getting that information now, except we are at the mercy of the executive branch to give it to us. And when I say the mercy of the executive branch, I'm speaking specifically of the Secretary of State's office. Now, John is absolutely correct. The Constitution gives the Secretary of State's office the audit function. It is for all financial accounts. But I believe that this and it's interesting how we like to selectively read things, but the Constitution also goes on to say, and other programs as defined by law. That means we as a legislature have the authority to pass something to the Secretary of State, and that which we have passed to the Secretary of State, we also have the authority to take it away. The argument will be made that it's unconstitutional for us to take away the performance audits from the Secretary of State's office and give it back to ourselves. If it was unconstitutional for us to do that, why was it constitutional for us to give it to them in 1987? In 1987, the legislature chose to take performance audits out of its own hands and put it into the hands of the executive branch. It was in that session. So my point here is that if it was not unconstitutional for us to give that to the Secretary of State's office in law, why is it unconstitutional for us to take it back? And what we really need is the ability for the legislature to have the kind of oversight that that we need to have to make some of the decisions that we make relative to the purse strings. There are some other bills, bill drafts that are going to be out there, Mr. Chair, and what I would like to encourage the committee to do, and I see it's not up for a possible work session today, so I appreciate that, is that when those other bills do come out, to take a look at them. For example, one of the proposals that will be out on the market is to create an Office of Legislative Audits as opposed to an office within LFO, or a Legislative Fiscal Office. It would also maintain the Joint Legislative Committee on Audits, or Joint Legislative Audits Committee, as opposed to creating a new committee that basically is the same. It also gives the legislature and JLAC the ability to hire a director and also to actually conduct the performance audits of the agencies. And then the one thing where the state audits division might get a little anxious is that it does also transfer the state waste and abuse hotline from the Secretary of State's office over to the legislature. It maintains the Secretary of State's office doing the financial audits just like they should, and I would argue that that's where their real focus should be, because one of the other duties of the Secretary of State's office is to oversee local governments, because every year local governments are by statute and by constitution must provide an audit of all of their accounts, and they have to report that to the Secretary of State's office. If the Secretary of State's office is busy doing performance audits on agencies, then are they able to do some of the things that they need to do relative to local governments and making sure that if they're not receiving those audits from local governments, then why not? That's supposed to be an annual audit. The other thing that, and 2057, I think, rightly, it eliminates the performance audits from the Secretary of State's office, and I think that's a good thing. And that it also defines what performance audits are. And I think that's a good thing. So what I'm suggesting that you may want to do as a committee, Mr. Chair, would be to take the other ideas that come out in the other bills that will be on the market and see what can be melded together and really create a very taking the recommendations from the commission and really creating a very good bill. One other point that I would like to make, and then Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take questions. It's been alluded to that the state auditor is in the audience. I'm sorry, but I don't see Secretary of State Bradbury in the audience. Now, I haven't turned around and looked since I heard the door open a minute ago, so maybe he's back there and I don't know it. But the state auditor is defined in the Constitution as a Secretary of State. It is not a staff person that's not elected. It is a Secretary of State. Now, we do have a Director of Audits, and he is in the audience. And it is his staff position to carry out the audit function and to direct the office. And I would have no argument there. But what I do have an argument with is people using a title that they have not stood for election and that they have not earned. It is a Secretary of State that is a state auditor. And I think that distinction needs to be understood and needs to be maintained. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Representative Cope? If not, thank you very much. Have one, Representative Thatcher?
I guess I want to maybe verify what I heard from you. Are your reasons that you believe that establishing this office within either LFO or at least on the legislative branch side would be because we need better oversight over agencies and the ability to analyze performance standards and outcomes and to figure out what we're getting for our money, because right now we're at the mercy of the executive branch. Did I understand it all, or did I miss something?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, no, you understood it correctly. And let me state something with regards to the Secretary of State's Audits Division, because it makes it sound like we're at loggerheads, and we're really not. I was co-chair of Joint Legislative Audits Committee in the interim. I was the chair of the House Audits Committee last year. I've looked at very hard at a number of agencies. But one of the things, when I say we're at the mercy of the Secretary of State's audit, when they begin an audit, there is certain information that until they have issued a report that is a draft report that then the agency has the opportunity to respond to, they cannot and will not, for confidentiality reasons, give that report to the legislature. So you have the executive branch looking after the executive branch, and we have to basically sort of take whatever we get from them. And I would argue that for us to have an adequate oversight, that we need the professional staff that can carry out the types of things and give us the kind type of information that we want at the time that we want it. You see, when the audits division, because they're in the executive branch, goes in to do an audit, literally the client is the agency. We, the legislature, the legislative branch, are not the client. Therefore, we are not entitled to that information until they being the Secretary of State's office, decides that they want to divulge the information or release the information to us. And I shouldn't say decides they want to. They have to adhere to confidentiality rules and audit ethics and standards, and I have no argument with that. And so I don't mean to make it sound like I'm attacking the Secretary of State's office, because I'm not. But for us to be the client, we have to have our own auditors, quite frankly. And I would also sort of, I guess, differ a little bit from the previous testimony in that calling it an audit, I think, is a good idea. A review is different than an audit. And that's where there's a little bit of difference in 2057, is because it while it defines what performance audits are on the back page, it does not talk about performance audits in the body of the bill. It talks about management and program reviews and evaluations. So there's a difference. And an audit can include a program evaluation and review, but a program evaluation and review doesn't necessarily automatically include an audit. So I hope I've made that clear. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yeah, but one follow-up. Previous testimony also suggested there wasn't a definition of a review. Would you suggest that there be one added?
Well, actually, he's correct, except that the bill does state that I believe it's on page 2, and I believe it is in it's in section 5, and if you look at, for example, line 25, parents 2 accept requests for performance program and management evaluations or reviews, and legislative committees and so on and so forth. And then at line 30, with the advice and assistance of a legislative fiscal officer or the director that determine performance program or management evaluations. And audit is actually deleted there. So what you would want to do would be to leave audits in there. But then on the final page, on page 8, is where it has the... That's within section 14, parents 4, and it defines what is determining performance audits. So does that answer your question, Representative?
I suppose so.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to have Mr. Rocco come to stand, if you would, please. I know you probably don't have prepared testimony because this was a request for you to come in. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this matter, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. Your staff asked me to be available to answer questions about this bill. What I'd like to tell you is that we did testify to the Public Commission on the Legislature when they were discussing this matter, and our recommendation was not to put it in within the Legislative Fiscal Office, but if the body wanted to have a legislative audit function, to have it as a standalone entity. A lot of the discussion came out of a bill last session. It was House Bill 2001, which created a legislative audit office independent of the fiscal office, and doing many of the things I believe that Representative Crummell was just referring to. In researching the fiscal impact of that measure last time, we determined that it is rare for a state not to have some type of an audit function. I think we found only 4 states, including Oregon, that did not have some type of a legislative audit activity. And based on that, we worked up a proposal under the previous House bill from last session of taking some of the performance and program evaluation auditing functions from the Secretary of State and using that those resources to finance a legislative audit office. At that time, we had a proposal together that would have cost about $3 million, and had a staff of about 13 people. We provided that information to the Public Commission in when they were discussing this concept, and so, you know, basically we're neutral on this. I did not ask for this to be put into my office. I have enough things to do right now. So, I guess with respect to the need of having program reviews and evaluations, I think, yes, they should be done. And that, as you're probably aware, over the past several sessions, the legislature has moved more towards performance-based budgeting and reviewing outcomes. One of the things that we intend, my office intends to do starting this next interim is starting to do some audits of those performance measure metrics that agencies are providing us through the budgeting process. So we're intending to pick that piece up. And I think if an audit office was created in the legislature, we would be very capable of working with them to discuss what types of audits needed to be done and consider the results of their reviews and, as part of the budget process, just like we do with the other staff offices in the building, Legislative Council and Legislative Revenue.
Any questions for Mr. Rocco?
Oh, a quick one.
Reverend Brad?
Yeah, this one is, again, it's terminology. I visualize an audit a lot different than a performance review. This is basically a performance evaluation. This is more performance evaluation oriented, is it not? And or am I missing something here?
I believe you're correct. It's more oriented towards those types of performance reviews or evaluations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rocky. We appreciate it. Chuck Hibner would come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hibner.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audit Division, not the State Auditor. A lot of information has been flowing around a bill, you know, and of course our office, and maybe happy to answer any questions you may have around that. We find ourselves in a particularly peculiar situation and somewhat awkward in that we were at the table when the commission was discussing this, and we certainly understand and we're all on board for accountability, and we were happy to be invited, and the sort of things that were being talked about, having a program evaluation department within the legislative body, seemed perfectly appropriate and consistent with what we've been tasked to do through the Constitution as the state's auditor. So that from that point of view, what is being recommended and talked about in this bill, which is not our bill, you know, we really don't have a position on whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. It's really up to you folks to determine what it is you need to do information functions. I certainly see it. You know, it certainly makes a lot of sense, but it's something that, of course, you folks need to decide. My role here, of course, is to protect what we think we need to be doing here. In deference to Mr. Latimer, who both was the legislative fiscal officer for some time and then my boss as the director of the Audit Division, I think he has a very good perspective on the sort of information that legislators may need. And I respectfully just acknowledge that that's probably the best source for the sort of testimony that shows kind of all sides of the discussion. Saying that we're supportive of what's in the body of it, we're also, I guess, there's consternation around the way that the summary was worded. And that one line in there that said it would statutorily remove the ability of the Audit Division to do, or the Secretary of State to do, performance and program evaluations. Though it may be technically correct, and I think if we discussed it in some detail, if you'd like to, I think you could see that it really doesn't have an effect on us, because the part that was, well, yeah, and you know, if you'd like to go there, the part that it's referring to is a repeal of a part of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee statute, which I think There's a section that talks about repealing a couple ORSs, ORS 171, 590, which within that, or I'm sorry, 297065, and within that statute.
Where is it?
I'm trying to find it. Like I said, this isn't our bill, so I'm trying
I'm
to.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I'd be happy to help. There is a section near the back where it talks about repealing these things.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I should have, and I can make copies for the committee if they like. I have I have the three-page handout that I did not make copies of, listing the ORS that would be repealed by the measure. It is 171590 and 297065 and 070.
Right, correct. And if I can just maybe recount the wording, if it's all right to read from prepared from the statute, it would be repealing the Joint Legislative Audit Committee's oversight of the conduct of Secretary of State audits or performance and program audits and program evaluations that are outside of our authority. Under Section 2, Article 6 of the Constitution. So we were doing performance audits prior to this statute being passed in 1997, and if it were to be repealed, we would continue to be able to do performance audits as a part of our mandate as we see it under the Constitution. And it's not just about financial audits, it's about fiscal and fiscal accountability, and trying not to use that term fiscal directly with the term financial. It's not a one for one. Fiscal accountability is much broader than just a financial audit. It's certainly an important component, but that's where we kind of get the discussion gets clouded. But to remove that part of the statute and reorganizing the Joint Legislative Audit Committee into something else, and the way it is summarized in the bill, though it technically may be accurate that there's a statutory there's statutory wording in that one statute that talks about the Secretary of State's ability to do performance audits that's outside of our already determined authority, is I'm not sure it really has an effect other than politically, where when we see that phrase, repeal statutory authority, we've now got legislators and others looking at this wondering, are we voting to remove performance audits from the Secretary of State, and therefore, you know, we're going to vote for it or not vote for it, and it's a political problem for us more than anything. So, to be in favor of the substance of the bill, and even with Mr. Latimer's comment about review, I agree. I mean, if there's any point at which a program evaluation may rub up or cross into what an audit would do, it's under trying to determine what a review would be, because it's more of a term of art. So we could you could find some crossover there, not a whole lot, I don't think, just because of the way that this is defined as a program evaluation office. But Chair, did you have a question?
I did. You talked about the rubbing up against the crossover, mm-hmm. and I don't see it as necessarily a bad thing. We don't get to see your audits until well after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to do oversight continually, and I don't necessarily see a problem with us looking at the same thing that you're looking at.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't disagree. I really wouldn't. And from my understanding of what, and this isn't my profession, I mean, I'm not a program evaluator, but I have done a little bit of research just to make sure I'm on at least fairly solid ground here. A program evaluation could most definitely look at the same sort of subject matters we look at. And I think the difference lies in kind of the layer at which you look at it. And after discussions with our attorney over at Department of Justice and trying to understand, kind of where that all sits, a program evaluation would more likely than not look at that first layer of performance measures and a sort of matrix that you give an agency when you give them a budget. You
right.
say you were expecting this sort of return. So an evaluator would go out, look at the program, cost benefit, whatever, and report that information back to you, probably fairly briskly. I would think a lot much more briskly than probably an audit would. And an audit would take it to that next level and do what we would consider to be economy and efficiency sort of review. Which would be a performance audit and not more of an evaluation or potentially described as a review, I guess. So I think you would be able to certainly look at the same subject, both from an evaluation point of view and an audit point of view, and get more depth, more likely than not, with the performance on it. And typically an affirmation, more of an attestation, that something is absolutely this way, and wrapped in all the standards that we do to make sure that we're documenting that as well.
Representative Rudd.
Yes, I was just going to kind of follow up on what John Latimer said.
Mm-hmm.
He pointed out in the bill, line 14 of page 1, that he wanted the word reviews restricted. And I'm kind of getting that sense from you, that it's poorly defined. Would you support that change? I know it's a small change, but I think that would kind of clean it up a little bit. And I see a tremendous amount of difference between an audit and a performance review. And I think what the chair was saying, there's probably a crossover line in there somewhere. But I don't see it. I'm having a hard time seeing where the bill actually does what the summary says. So,
Chair Riley, Representative Gerard, I would support that, and I testified to that effect in front of the commission, that I thought that was one of those gray areas where if we aren't communicating clearly with the new body that's being created here, that we could be duplicating some efforts and get into some areas of constitutional things that we just didn't want to go to. So if that change was made, I think it would clarify for the parties what their areas of responsibility is, what sort of standards they would be following, because I'm not aware of review standards. I'm aware of a program evaluation standards, mm-hmm. and I'm aware of auditing standards, but I'm not aware of what standards you'd apply to review.
Okay. Just for the committee's information, staff will be providing you with the language that is referred to as being repealed. So you'll be seeing that this afternoon.
Okay.
Any other? Did you have a question?
No, I think he answered it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this matter? If not, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2057. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2222.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2222 modifies requirements in statute for employer safety committees. It directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules that provide for alternative forms of safety committees and safety meetings. You'll notice that the staff measure summary indicates that no fiscal impact statement has yet been issued. That is still the case. However, speaking to the indications are that this will have no fiscal impact.
Thank you. I'm going to start with Mr. Wood. If you would come up, please. Thank you for coming, and go ahead and give your name and your position and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I am the administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division, what we call Oregon OSHA, which is within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I am here today to provide information and request the committee's support for House Bill 2222. The bill was introduced at our request to improve the employee involvement requirements that are contained in the existing ORS 654, also referred to as the Oregon Safe Employment Act. This language was part of the workers' compensation reforms passed in 1990, recognizing the value of controlling workers' compensation costs by preventing injuries and illnesses in the first place, and also recognizing the critical importance of dealing with injuries and illnesses and risks in the workplace by having meaningful employee involvement. You have written testimony in front of you that I provided. I will touch on a couple high points from that and be available to answer questions. I won't belabor the bulk of it. I do want to mention that because The statute in question was part of those workers' compensation reforms. We did take the proposal to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which advises the department on workers' compensation issues, and received their endorsement for the change. Essentially, the existing statute includes several requirements. First of all, every employer with more than 10 employees is required to establish and administer a safety committee. There's some additional guidance in a separate section of the statute about what the rules regarding safety committees must include, but that requirement in its essence is fairly straightforward. It becomes more confusing for smaller employers. Employers with 10 or fewer employees are required to establish and administer a safety committee if they meet one of the following criteria. The first is if the employer has a lost workday case incidence rate in the top 10% of all employers in the same industry. The second is for non-agricultural employers if the industry is in the top 25% of all industries in the state. So small employers can hit one of two triggers, either based on their individual experience in comparison with the industry's experience or based on the industry's experience. That data, of course, isn't something that the typical small business is spending a lot of time thinking about or massaging. One thing to be conscious of is that top 10% threshold is not as high as it sounds. When we're looking at a fairly short period and talking about small businesses, and certainly in low to moderate risk industries, small businesses will reach that threshold by having a disabling claim. That one claim will put them across the list. There's an example in my testimony that I want to offer, and this is really how this issue first came to my attention. Shortly after taking the job, not quite a year and a half ago, I had a conversation with an employer, and she was calling because we had sent her a letter indicating that her business had an exceptionally high disabling claims rate. And she called, and as I recall the conversation, it was something along the lines of, well, you know, wait a minute, we haven't had a claim, you know, we've only had one claim in 25 years, how can that be a very high rate? And I said, well, when did you have the claim? And she said, well, last year. I said, well, we're looking at a 12-month period. I said, I assume you're probably a fairly small business. And she said, well, yes, we just had the one guy, and he only helped out part-time. One part-time employee had a disabling claim. You can imagine when you calculate that on a rate, how high that rate is, and it makes absolutely no sense at all to tell that employer that they have to have a safety committee, which presumably would mean they'd have to bring the part-time employee in, perhaps on light duty shortly after the injury, so that he could be the employee representative of the safety committee. The requirement makes sense, and employee involvement is critical, but when you get to small employers, it begins to create some difficulty. The other issue that I want to highlight has to do with mobile industries. This is primarily an issue in construction, but not exclusively. There are other industries that have small crews of two, three, sometimes even one employee working alone, and using a traditional safety committee format to deal with their safety and health issues probably is not the most effective model, and it certainly, we've heard from employers, can be cumbersome in complying with the requirements. What we're asking for here, rather than trying to work out all the new details in the statute, is we're asking you to eliminate the obstacles to us using our rulemaking authority to address these and to providing some specific guidance about the need to take into account the needs of small employers and employers with mobile work sites. I know that there are some who have concern, the Farm Bureau in particular, it's come to my attention, who have concern about leaving the department with that much of broad authority in addressing those issues. I think we can address their concerns, both in the context of further discussions of the bill and ultimately in the rulemaking. The example I just gave of the small employer was, in fact, an agricultural employer. The existing exemption didn't do her any good because she was caught by the other threshold. We also have run into problems at times trying to provide greater flexibility to employers, including employers in the agricultural community, because we've run up against the language in the statute. We've endeavored over the years to try to provide as much flexibility and as much rationality as possible to the safety committee requirement, and the reality is that we bump into the fact that the statute says safety committee and doesn't really provide for less formal structures like safety meetings than in the case of smaller employers and employers in certain other contexts are more effective in providing protection to employees. I remain convinced that this bill would enable us to have less onerous requirements, eliminate some of those absurd results like the one I just described, and at the same time provide greater protection to employees in the state. I thank you for your attention, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Representative Grodd.
Yes, thank you. The question being, I'm trying to look out for Farm Bureau's interest as well, in the rulemaking authority. So what you're summarizing is saying is that you want some flexibility with the rules so that people that come under a certain rule or regulation that you think shouldn't have triggered it, that you would have some flexibility to give them the leeway and the benefit of the doubt. Is that kind of what you were saying, or am I missing the boat here?
Chair Riley, Representative Gerard, I think that's essentially correct. We want to be able to provide reasonable flexibility to employers that takes into account the various situations that employers of different sorts in all the various industries within the state may face.
Representative Thatcher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, I had a little bit of consternation when I saw the bill at first, and then I thought, well, maybe if we can provide for alternate forms of, I'm looking at the wrong bill, of setting up the safety committees, maybe that's a good thing. But who is going to be doing that? And it kind of goes back to that statement you had earlier that there's concern over giving broad authority to OSHA. And, yeah, I would say that would be a fear of many small employers. And I would hope that you would get input from a broad spectrum of employers that have, say, 24-hour jobs like that are not the single-site 9-to-5 types of industries.
Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, yes, we certainly would get input. My written testimony reflects a commitment to having a collaborative rulemaking process. In order to have these rules make sense and achieve the goal that we're pursuing, we have to be engaged in discussion with the folks that they're going to apply. In this context, I think it's even more important than it typically is to have that broad discussion and have a full discussion about the way various requirements may deal with various situations. I'm conscious of the fact that, although we talk about it a lot in the context of construction, that there certainly are other businesses where it's also an issue. There are a wide range of businesses that use small crews and don't have any sort of regular central meeting or central interaction contact. I believe that there are ways that we can work that out. I'm hesitant to think that I can suggest language to be enshrined in statute that would address those concerns.
One follow-up. Mm-hmm. My next question would be, how would a small employer know? Okay, now you that have never had to have a safety committee because you've always had 9 and under and you've been perfectly safe, no injuries, but now you do. And if OSHA comes in, inspects, and finds out, well, you haven't been, I would be really nervous to say, well, now they get penalized. So I'm hoping there's going to be some leeway granted by OSHA.
Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, there really are two things that we'll do in response to that issue. The first is that if the bill passes and we subsequently modify the rules, we will certainly engage on an extensive educational campaign. One of the difficulties we face now is we have to deal with educating employers when the list of industries change or letting them know what the rate is in their industry. So we have a lot of small employers who pass in and out of the requirement without ever knowing it. The other thing, and you touched on this, is that when it comes to a matter of enforcement policy, when we go in and find that a safety committee is not there and that that's the only problem in the work site, typically that would be an other than serious violation. It would not carry a penalty, and in fact I think we would adopt policy to make it clear that our staff shouldn't be looking at issuing penalties in those cases for the period of time after the rule takes effect.
Mr. Representative Edwards.
I applaud the effort. It sounds like the intent is to make it easier for small business. What I'm wondering, my question is, who is involved in the process of getting to this? And you might have spoken to it already, but I didn't catch it. I mean, you said you know of some concerns on the part of the Farm Bureau. What other groups and organizations have you like the Farm Bureau, only their cohorts and other industries have you spoken with?
Chair Riley, Representative Edwards, as we developed the legislative concept, we had discussions with a number of business associations as well as labor representatives. I would hesitate to say that this is necessarily a complete list, but we certainly talked to the Associated General Contractors. We talked to the ABC. We talked to the home builders last fall. We've had conversation with a number of folks within the construction industry. We also spoke with the National Federation of Independent Business, with AOI. And we did shop the concept to the Farm Bureau. It's obvious at this point that that I should have looped around and tightened that up a bit as we began to develop final language. So we had a broad discussion. In addition, I have a committee that we call the Partnership Committee that is essentially an advisory committee to me in the context of Oregon OSHA, and we've discussed the proposal extensively in that group. We've also talked about it in our Construction Advisory Committee, which is a group, as indicated, focused on construction. And then, as I said, we did take it to the Management Labor Advisory Committee that addresses workers' compensation issues.
Thank you.
Are you able to stick around for a while in case we have more questions?
Chair Riley, I will be here until the end of the hearing.
Thank you. In that case, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
So, Jessica Adamson, Joe Miller, and Randy Hedy. I may have massacred that last name.
Ledick.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're pleased to be here in support of this bill that makes important changes to safety committees for the construction industry, making it easier for, we believe, for our employers to comply with important safety requirements. We represent a wide range of businesses, from very large employers to the very small. And across the board, safety is our first priority and something we spend a lot of time on with our members. But regardless of employer size, we encourage employers to take proactive measures to improve their safety rating, and regardless of size, to have a safety committee to utilize that process to improve their company's standards and to avoid injuries. Here with me today is Joe Miller, AGC's Safety and Loss Control Manager, and Randy Ledick with Wildish Construction Companies to talk about Wildish's concerns and their support for this bill as well. So with no further ado, unless you have any questions, I'd like to turn it over to them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randall Ledick, here on behalf of the Wildish Construction Companies to lend our support to at least Section 2 of House Bill 2222. By way of background, Wildish is a family-owned rock product supplier and general construction contractor that has been in business in the state of Oregon since 1935. Although we're home-based in Eugene, we build highways, bridges, runways, water treatment plants, stadiums, and other facilities across the state. We employ between 400 and 500 people. Our current workers' compensation rating is 0.85. That's a safety indicator that is better than the industry average. At our home office location, we've been able to organize our safety committee in the manner that was originally and currently prescribed by law. That is, representatives from our sand and gravel production crew, the automotive repair shop, our truck drivers, various local construction crews, and office staff meet regularly to discuss safety matters, review accidents, and conduct inspections. Minutes of these meetings are kept and then distributed to each operating section. As helpful as these sessions are in raising safety awareness among employees and company management, in order to really reach all of the members of our construction crews, we found it necessary to continue with other approaches that are more common to the construction industry. In this regard, our project managers and field supervisors conduct job-specific safety meetings on a regular basis, perform site inspections, and implement an effort that we call the Safe Performance Observation Card Program. We also have an incentive awards program established, and enforcement practices are in place. where the traditional safety committee structure becomes especially difficult to implement is at our remote project locations. It just isn't practical to have crew representatives from jobs located in Portland, Bandon, Baker City, and all points in between travel to Eugene to participate on our safety committee. And even if this was feasible, the job-specific nature of the hazards that our crew members encounter would still make it necessary for us to supplement our safety efforts with the types of activities that I just mentioned. What we have done in recent years to comply with the intent of the safety committee law is, in essence, create project-specific safety committees at each of our remote locations. Monthly, the entire crew, from project manager to the newest laborer, gathers together for a safety meeting that is more structured than a weekly crew safety meeting might be. In regard to the requirements of the current safety committee law, do these project-specific committees have equal numbers of employee and employer representatives? No. Are the employee members volunteers or elected by their peers? No. Do they keep written records and are the members paid while attending the meeting? Yes. Do they conduct inspections, investigate accidents, evaluate programs, and prescribe training? To a certain degree. More importantly, the question needs to be asked, has this modified project-specific safety committee approach promoted health and safety? The answer to that is most definitely. These meetings have raised safety awareness and enhanced communication among crew members and management, and that is what the safety committee law is intended to achieve. The law as it is currently written seems most appropriate in an office or manufacturing setting where hazards associated with activities and facilities are rather static in nature. Construction hazards, on the other hand, are dynamic since a worker's surroundings are constantly changing from project to project and even moment to moment. The provision of House Bill 2222, which allows employers with mobile work sites to meet the intent of this law with alternative forms of safety committees and safety meetings, will give those of us in the construction industry a practical means to meet the intent of the law. Your approval of the proposal is requested and appreciated. We certainly appreciate your time and interest, and I'd be happy to answer whatever questions I might be able to.
Thank you very much. And you have further testimony?
Yes, Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Miller. I'm Safety and Loss Control Manager for the Oregon Columbia Chapter of the Associated General Contractors. AGC has about 110 members throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. We also have a staff of 9 consultants that provide safety and health services to our members. I'm here today representing AGC and to testify in support of House Bill 2222. Our members are committed to providing a safe and healthful workplace for their employees and understand the role that effective safety committees play in achieving that. Virtually all of our members have functioning safety committees and strive to meet the current or OSHA requirements. The problem is that the rules as currently structured make it very difficult for many of our members to achieve strict compliance and are less effective than other safety communication methods, particularly for those members doing highway or road work where their crews are scattered throughout the state. For those employers, it is very difficult to get field representatives to centralize safety committee meetings on a monthly basis. OSHA's changes to allow alternative forms of safety committee structures for small employers and mobile crews, such as in construction, could allow our members to use documented weekly site safety meetings where all crew members are present as an alternative to the monthly centralized committee structure. In closing, I want to reiterate that AGC members are a strong proponent of safety committees, and many of our members have very effective committees under the current structure. We feel, however, that this change would give those members where the structure does not work well the flexibility to develop alternative means to more effectively communicate safety to their employees. Thank you.
Representative Grodd.
Yes, thank you, and I appreciate your testimony. I'm kind of going over the bill here, and on the second page, lines 9 through 11 seem to be the crux of what you're saying, where it says prescribing alternate forms of safety committees and safety meetings to meet the special needs of small employers, agriculture employers, and employers with mobile work sites. So you don't see the open-endedness of OSHA's request as being threatening, and the crux of your being a proponent is based on kind of on those lines. Is that
that's correct? The current rules are really very inflexible. I see this as giving flexibility to Oregon OSHA. Okay. Some would say, well, you know, can you trust them? I believe that processes can be put in place whereby we would have our input into the administrative rule process. So we feel that this is a definite, you know, a positive step, because the structure now is in the law, and it makes it very difficult to provide for the flexibility to make more effective procedures.
I'll follow up. And this is, if you listen to Representative Thatcher's testimony before, or question before, asking if you know ahead of time what the structure is, at least you have kind of a rule book to go by. And if it's open-ended, how, just kind of curious, how would you know if you're in compliance or non-compliance if you're not contacted by OSHA directly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, there still will be rules written. You know, the Oregon administrative rules, you know, the steps and processes would be outlined in administrative rule. So there will be a rule book, a guide, once those are completed, and we would like to be involved in that process and have input in that process.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 9 through 11 on the second page, where it refers to meeting the, you know, prescribing alternate forms to meet the needs of small employers, agricultural employers, and employers with mobile work sites. Do you think that is it a long enough list? Does that address the people? You talked about multiple work sites all over the state, and it doesn't talk about here. Would that be considered a mobile work site? Should that be added? Or should there be a little amendment to say employers with that are not, you know, maybe part of the single site, nine to five, like I was saying earlier, just to make sure we get them all? Otherwise, I would feel like we could be possibly limiting ourselves.
Is that me?
Anybody feels like answering that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think it's our perspective that the mobile worksite component picks up construction for the most part. We would be open to an amendment to make sure that it picked up all of those employers, multiple work sites. If that is a pleasure of the committee, we have no quarrel with that.
Just a comment. I mean, you got people that maybe telecommute too, that are all over the state and never see each other. And I don't know if that would qualify as a mobile work site, and they could be a medium employer. I mean, so it would fit under small. I just want to make sure that we're making it flexible for all the special needs that are out there. Just occurred to me while I heard you testifying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, we would be open to that. We think that the we also just want to highlight real quick on page 1, line 8, we believe keeping the language in there about holding safety meetings is also a critical component, because we think that the other that by allowing safety meetings to be to meet it through that means, as opposed to a traditional safety committee, those will provide the kind of flexibility that our employers need.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate you being here to testify.
Thank you.
I want to call J.L. Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Riley and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the National Federation of Independent Business on this bill. And I want to make sure the committee knows, on balance, we do support the bill. And I do say on balance because, as Representative Thatcher alluded to, it took us a little bit to get there, but I'll take you through the thought process for us anyways. When Director Wood consulted us about this bill this summer, I certainly appreciated his intent and where he wanted to go with the bill, and that was important to us. My concern, I also appreciated it in light of the fact that we have had, at least my members, somewhat of a rocky relationship with OSHA, and it's nice to see that it's becoming more collaborative and the relationship is mending. But from our point of view, my concern is with the small companies. The employers who employ 10 or fewer is my constituency. I represent about 12,000 of them. And I understood the intent to allow alternate forms of safety committees and meetings or some other way to meet the intent of the law without perhaps prescribing a rigid rule. But my thought process, well, what about those employers who are not in the top 10% of their rate category in workers' comp claims? Or how about those who are not, whose industry is not in the top 25% of rates for workers' comp? That's a whole host of small employers who are currently not subject to this regulation. And on balance, after having given it a lot of thought, I believe, given the sponsors of this bill, that their intent is to grant flexibility to small companies. I believe the intent of the sponsors is good. I take them at their word when they give me their written affirmation that we will be included in the rulemaking process. I don't have a lot of heartburn over the rules process. We've obviously, as lobbyists, we've been engaged in that many times, and it's collaborative, and usually there is a good outcome. So that doesn't give me a lot of heartburn. I put a lot of stock in the Management Labor Advisory Committee endorsement. I chaired that committee for 5 years. I know how thoroughly those proposals are vetted in that committee, and they have to pass muster with both employers and labor representatives. So I wanted to say, on balance, for the small companies, even for those who are in the 90%, you know, not the top 10% of their in their category for workers' comp claims, and not in the top 25% of industries, if there's not a compelling case to include them under the safety committee regulation and rule, then we can in fact write that in rule. So I don't feel that we necessarily have to apply a safety committee burden to people who currently don't face that burden if there's not a compelling reason. And I feel that I should be able to make that case in the rulemaking process as well. So again, on balance, we support the bill, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Just a quick question, and you say that you don't have any heartburn on the rulemaking decisions or when they come to do an administrative rule. What happens if they do put through an administrative rule that, for example, that would give you heartburn? What do you do? What's your recourse other than to come to the legislature?
Well, I guess that Chair Riley and Representative Garrett, I guess that is my recourse, to come to the legislature. But I've been through this process enough to believe in not only do I, and a lot of it is, you know, I take it as an article of faith of the good intention of the sponsors and that we're willing to work collaboratively. So there's only so much I can go on, and everything that's been said is workable for us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don Schoenberg? Thank you for coming today, and begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. I'm Don Schoenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. We do have concerns about the bill, and I do applaud the department for the intent, and the intent stated on page 2. That's a laudable intent. Unfortunately, I can't say that agriculture has had the confidence of all of the state agencies that's been spoken of here over the years. And when I read the bill, my first thought was, what's the name of this committee again? Government Accountability. And I look at this bill, and it removes the statutory language regarding criteria for safety committees and puts all of that language in the hands of the agency. And I'm thinking, well, where's the accountability? Agencies don't really have any accountability. At least we haven't been able to find any. Now, I would also hasten to say that we have worked with the OSHA department over recent years in a very collaborative way. Having said that, then I have to go back and say that somebody's going to have to remind me, as I do not remember at all, having any indication that this kind of legislation was even going to be proposed. It came out just a couple days ago, and then here we are at a hearing already. And I was a little bit taken back. So my concern, again, is the accountability aspect. Not to say that we can't work with the department. I would like the opportunity to work with the department and see what we can do to resolve the issue. The director has some valid points regarding agriculture, and the example he used of the agriculture producer is a problem that we have. You have one employee, one part-time employee, and all of a sudden you have to have a safety committee. Well, what's the criteria? Obviously isn't working right. Needs some different criteria. Should that criteria be in the statute, or should it be in the rule? That's one of the basic questions. We would prefer to see the criteria in the statute. You have accountability because you are elected each session. The department doesn't have that accountability. The only accountability we have there is through the governor's office. The only way that we can register our concern would be changing the governor. And that's a big order. Only happens every 4 years. So, again, that is our issue with the bill. Again, not what the intent of what the department's trying to do. I think what they're trying to do is a good thing. How we get there is our concern. And, again, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to continue to work with them on finding a solution to this. Thank you.
Representative Graham. Don, I kind of agree with you in that I think that the intent of this is actually a pretty good intent, and I understand your fear with the rulemaking process. I know it'd be kind of a ticklish thing, and I'm not sure it can be done, but if we put something in here that would involve, if there was a question on the administrative rule that it could be reviewed by the legislative body, that would pretty well take care of your needs, would it not?
Chair Riley and Representative Garrard, that can only happen every roughly 18 months. Yeah. Now, and I'm not trying to make an argument for annual sessions here, but yeah. If you have annual sessions, yeah, then they're, well, unless they're limited to financial issues, you still would only have one opportunity every 18 months to address those issues.
So that wouldn't rectify the problem?
Chair Riley, Representative Garrard, not in our opinion.
Okay. Don, we do have interim committees that hear these kinds of things. You don't think that, you know, those interim committees are work, or, you know, why is it only every 18 months? Because you do have interim committees.
Chair Riley, that's correct. You do have interim committees. However, they don't have any authority to do anything. You get the bullet pulpit. That's correct, but that's the extent of it.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have a question maybe that might need to be addressed to Mr. Wood.
Would you come back up, and if you could just stay down and he'll just join you, if that's okay? You guys are not going to fight there right now.
Thank you. Mr. Wood, do you have any idea how long you think a rulemaking process would take?
For the record, your name again, please.
For the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I was, as I listened to the conversation that was just passing, I was giving that some thought myself. First of all, given the need to involve the wide range of parties and develop really effective rules, I think it's, you know, I can put a lower end on it. I cannot imagine that we would have rules in place and effective before January 1st of next year. Added to that, the need to do some fairly aggressive outreach in order to educate folks, I think we would be several months after that before we were actually enforcing them in any meaningful form or capability. I do think it would be an extensive rulemaking process that would take some considerable time, and frankly, more time than we usually spend in our routine rulemaking.
Thank you. Not necessarily follow up, but more of a comment. I think that kind of shortens that 18-month period that someone had concerns about, because most likely something wouldn't even be in effect until a few months before we met again. And at that, even after, you know, we might have an idea when we do come back, if we do come back in February of next year, that we could look at. So, I think there are some ways of alleviating some of the concern.
Would you like to address that, Don?
As Chair Riley and Representative Beyer, that what the director has said or the administrator has said is true, and what you're suggesting is true if that is in fact the timeline. There have some that have been a lot shorter than that that we've had to deal with, not from that department necessarily, but other departments that we've had to deal with. So it varies. Okay. It can be long, can be short.
Thank you.
Representative Brad, this is a follow-up question to her. That would be under this biennium. You would have the rulemaking authority for perpetuity with this bill, would you not? Or am I missing something here? I know that
you can always change it next session.
Well, I realize that, but that would require going through the House of the Governor, and you never know exactly what's going to happen. But that this
you
would
make that happen, Representative.
Yeah, I'm a real powerful person here. I remember that, Chair.
Yeah, right? There you go.
Chair Riley, Representative Grodd, and again, my name is Michael Wood, the administrator of Oregon OSHA, for the record. It's true that the requirement to use our rulemaking authority would remain in the statute. I might point out that the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services actually has fairly broad rulemaking authority already under the statute. Mm-hmm. That's subject to relatively few limitations. One of those limitations with regard to Oregon OSHA specifically is that the any rulemaking that we do that affects small agricultural employers, we have to consult with a statutory committee known as the Small Agricultural Employer Advisory Committee. So there actually is a statutory requirement for collaboration. We do that routinely in relation to all industries, but the statutory requirement is actually unique to agriculture.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be of any comfort to you, Don, to say that they have a time limit or a sunset on these authorities?
Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, that always would be some comfort, yes, because what a sunset does is require that we revisit the issue and see if it's still working.
Mm-hmm.
That's a possibility. I would, quite frankly, would rather we see if we can work it out and come to an amicable agreement. Would be my preference.
Okay. If there are no other questions, I'm going to give you that time. I'm not going to hold a work session today. I'm going to give you until sometime next week. And if that's sufficient for you, Don, do you think that's long enough for you guys to talk?
Chair Riley, that's long enough to talk. I'm not sure it was long enough to come to a decision.
Well,
we both have a lot of work to do, and with the legislative process, this isn't the only issue that I have to deal with, but I understand you wanting to not drag this.
Right, I don't want to drag it along. If you can work together and Representative Garrod, would you like to join them to work on this?
I would very much enjoy that.
Okay, and I think if we could, get that moving and get it done as soon as we can, I'd like to do something with this bill in the next 3 weeks. So, if you guys can work that out. Yes, Representative Biden.
Well, I was going to let you finish your thoughts.
No, go ahead.
I guess I wanted to go back, and I'm wondering if something I missed in your testimony, but how long has this rule that's in effect been in effect?
Chair Riley, Representative Beyer, for the record, my name is Michael Wood, the Administrator of Oregon OSHA. It is in my written testimony. I believe it has been in effect since May of 1980.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay, well, is there anybody else who would like to testify on this today before I close the public hearing? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing, and thank you very much, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Yep. And I'm going to go ahead and close the House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology, and we'll see you next week.